conversation. Mr. Roy Wilkins, proceed.
You were speaking a moment ago, while we were changing tape, of the matter of confidence in young Negroes or old Negroes, but in a sense that their history has helped build this confidence.
Yes, indeed it has. Those who have taken the trouble to read their history have found that struggle was going on before the 1960s, before the Second World War in 1942, and before the First World War, and back even in slavery days, the struggle was going on.
Let me ask this question in that connection. What accounts for the timing then of the so-called Negro Revolution of the last few years, with this impulse, as you say, existing over a long period of time, what brings it into the open now in an effective way, a general and effective way, a highly organized way?
I think this is the result of accumulation of events, accumulation of developments. I think, first of all, we had the emotional stimulus of the 100 years since the Emancipation Proclamation, 1963. It was an emotional year, centennial, an anniversary. They looked around them and they said, it's been 100 years and look where we are. We aren't here and we aren't there and we aren't there and we aren't there. This gave a lot of impetus. Secondly, I think we have to reckon with the fact that it took a number of years to build up an educated cadre of youngsters, fathers, and grandfathers who cumulatively built resistance and resentment against the things they suffered. This couldn't help but explode. After you graduate, 100 high school graduate this year. You graduate 1,000 5 years from now. You graduate 10,000. You graduate 25,000. You keep on graduating them. And finally, you get to the place where that number of graduates will say, well, this is untenable. I can't stand it. We must push. That was one factor. Mr. Warren, you had migrations from the South to the North, beginning with World War I. A large number of Negroes came up to Gary and Youngstown and Akron, the industrial centers, and they settled down. They became voters, and they went to school, and they sent their children to school. More importantly, along about 1930, they became political factors in the Matzke, the Republican machine in Cleveland, in the Big Bill Thompson Republican machine in Chicago, in the Pendergast machine, Democratic in Kansas City.
The Crump one in Memphis, Tennessee.
And the Crump one in Tennessee, and the Vare machine in Pennsylvania, the Republican machine. And Tammany was nibbling and playing with the idea of the Negro. So that he became a political factor, and this was a build-up, too. All of this was a build-up to the 1960s. But then you had Great Britain. You had two world wars, too. You had a war against to save the world for democracy, in the words of Woodrow Wilson. And Negroes came from the swamps and the plantations and the cotton fields, and they went overseas, and they saw Paris, and they saw Berlin, and they saw Europe, they saw London. And they came back, and they knew there was a world outside of their particular county, and there were different kind of white people there, and different things were underway. And in World War II, you had them fighting against the master race theory. They could go back to Terrell County, Georgia, and find the master race theory, too. And this was not lost upon them. And finally, in 1960, you had the pileup from the 1954 school decision, the defiance of it, the refusal to obey it, the attack upon the Supreme Court, the attempt to change the rules after the game had been won. The Negro thought he had won in 1954. His citizenship had been reaffirmed. His constitutional basis of his life had been reaffirmed by the Supreme Court, who said we can't discriminate on account of race. But discrimination went on. The Southern legislators passed laws, and they obstructed this and that and the other. Finally, in the 1960s, the Negro broke loose and took direct action. He said, we can't depend on legislatures, and we go to the courts, and we take 50 years to go slowly through the courts and chip away at the separate but equal, and we win in 1954, but we don't win. So let's get out on the streets and take it directly to the seat of government. And that's what happened. And I believe that's the reason you had the revolt in the 1960s and not in the 1950s.
I don't imagine it surprises you if I should say that a good many Negroes flinch from your explanation. I don't know how many, but some, and I know. Because it implies over a period of time a process. You see, the grandfather, the father, the grandson, bit of the cadre of educated people with a will of a, directed toward immediate achievement. It seems to say process always means the gradual, and therefore it affects the present, you see. Because once they process, as one young man, a student, said to me on this connection, he said, I understand that change takes place in time, you see, and that there's no absolute solution, no immediate solution for any social problem. But he suddenly said, but I can't bring myself to say it.
Yes.
It's the emotional drive, the emotional attitude is opposed to the intellectual grasp of the process.
Yes, that's true. And I sympathize with that young man, absolutely. I know exactly how he feels. But nevertheless, the fact remains that except in certain instances, certain situations, no immediate change can take place. A change in attitudes can be either induced or forced or brought about by persuasion. And these changes in attitude will in due time bring changes in fact.
And vice versa.
Yes. I feel, I know that the Negro shrinks from the use of this word gradualism or even the concept of gradualism.
Process is a bad word.
Yes, he just doesn't like that at all. And yet, if you read history, even in this country, if you read the history only of the labor movement, if he read the history of the struggle for a child labor law, one segment of the labor movement, if he read the story of the struggle of the labor unions to get rid of the injunction, the use of the injunction against them, if he read of all the labor struggles prior to the Norris-LaGuardia Act and the Wagner Labor Act, when labor really got its charter in the middle 1930s, he would understand that while you never, never, never give up or compromise, that things don't happen overnight.
This is a question then of what freedom now means, what the slogan can mean. What is its content? It leads us to that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And I think the answer is very, well, it's not very simple. Nothing is simple. Freedom now means just that. It means away with the old concepts. It means a beginning, a real, solid, good faith beginning on new concepts. I think that young student you were talking to realizes that you don't change overnight. But he wants Mississippi or Alabama or South Carolina or Louisiana to set its face in the direction of change and to make meaningful steps toward change that carried out successively can lead to what he wants. Now, he's very quick to detect, and I am, and all Negroes are, very quick to detect those phony steps toward change, those pretensions, those delays, those take it or leave it, or these teaspoonfuls that they give you here and there instead of giving you the whole pot of soup. Negroes will have no truck with this sort of thing in this kind of revolution.
Let's take the word revolution for a moment. In what sense is the revolution a revolution? We're fooling with the word now, but
yes.
Behind the word, what is the reality? How does it correspond to, or how far does it correspond to something as the French Revolution or the American Revolution?
I don't believe it corresponds to those because we are not here seeking to overthrow a government or to set up a new government. We are here trying to get the government as expressed by a majority of the people, to get the government to put into practice its declared objectives. This is a little different kind of a revolution, it seems to me. We're also not in a revolution, as has been said over and over again, not a revolution of despair, but a revolution of rising expectations. In other words, the Negro wants in. He wants to share within the American life. His outpouring in Washington on August 28, 1963 was an outpouring saying, let me in to the good things of American life. Stop denying me. It was not a revolution. It was not an outpouring which said, let's get rid of this government and put in a new government that will give me a chance.
Not to liquidate a regime, but to join a regime.
Exactly so.
Exactly. There's another aspect, another problem, might mean a difference between other revolutions. Revolutions live on hope and they live on hate. The hope for the change, the expectation of change, otherwise a mere servile revolt or a desperate insurrection. But a real revolution lives on a hope. It's hope of change, accomplishment. Otherwise it can't organize itself. It also lives on this mobilizing of the force through a hate. It's the guillotine has to operate. Revolution of the past. You have to hate somebody. The question now is how the hope side is clear in this movement. How the hate side, the motive, the drive toward the squirt of adrenaline that makes it possible to act. How that is provoked, channelized, and contained. If the movement looks toward it joining, it's joining with, in one sense, quotes, the enemy.
Yes. I don't
have a problem. You see, is there some problem around this side of the mountain? Now, it's easy when you look at Malcolm X.
Yes.
It's easy there with the black Muslims.
Yes.
And it's easy when you take an extreme situation, going the other way and take a Quaker.
Yes.
You see.
Yes.
It's easy. Extremes are simple. They adapt itself.
Yes.
But now in the great world, the great body of people, of Negroes in between these two extreme positions, the problem emerges in one way or another, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes, I guess so. I don't envisage the Negro employing hate as a tactic, as a recognized procedure to mobilize support for his side or to win objectives for his side. I, of course, do not rule out the fact that here and there individually, as between two individuals, or in a small groups, there might be something akin to hate as a motivation for action.
I think we have to face that fact that it's a component.
Exactly.
Human nature and human responses.
Exactly.
And they're kind of provocations.
But I don't see the Negro in this country adopting hatred as a tactic. In the first place, if he had believed in hatred as a tool, and if he had been on to a widespread degree subject to hatred, or capable of employing it, maintaining it, and feeding it, and using it, he would have done so long ago. I once said about Malcolm X, he's talking about rifle clubs in 1964, and violence, and shedding blood. If the Negro had believed in that, he would have used it a long time ago when he was much worse off than he is now.
Of course, Mr. Abbott has said this once. We believe in the nonviolent approach as a matter of philosophy and ethics. Also, he said, with his infectious grin, the white folks had more guns.
Yes, yes, that's true. And the Negro has never forgotten the fact. As a matter of fact, the Negro in this country is a very practical and pragmatic animal. And he has never lost sight of the elementary facts of survival. And he never has forgotten that he's a 10% minority in this country, numerically. And that economically and politically, he is a much greater minority than 10%. So that he does not have the power, except the moral power, to mobilize. How many guns, to put it bluntly, how many guns can he get?
But, shall we say, with any movement is always a movement of power.
Yes.
It's a question of the nature of the power that's
yes.
involved. Is that it, Dan?
Yes, yes. And he has, on his side, and he has utilized, I think, magnificently, the moral power that he has. He has the power of moral righteousness on his side. And he has something else. The United States is vulnerable because of its declared purposes. Now, if it had an ambiguous constitution, or if it had an ambiguous Declaration of Independence, this would be different. But the Declaration of Independence says all men. Now, there were some squabbles over the Constitution, of course. There were some people there who didn't want it to mean what we now say it means. But this was resolved in the usual way. There are a lot of people now who don't believe in liquor control, let's say, or fair price laws, or import duties on watches, on hides, yes, say. The tanners want duties on hides. The watch people don't much care whether they have duties on hides or not, and so forth and so on. Well, we resolve this question of what our Constitution, but America is on record the haven of all the oppressed peoples of the world. This is the land where you can come and demonstrate your ability and achieve on the basis of your ability. If you're a Hungarian, when you get here, you will become an American. And if you're an Irishman, when you get here, you become an American.
What do you think of the notion that some sociologists or historians have enunciated, that the American Negro is more like the old America than like any other element in our culture?
Some people have said that, and it's...
The old Yankee or the old Southerner?
It's probably
old
true.
White Southerner.
It's probably true. He is.
He's an old American, too.
He is. He is. He's a very old American, and he's American in his concepts. He's... I think he's liberal only on the race question. I mean, I think he's a conservative economically, I think he wants to hold on to gains and property and protection. I may be wrong, but I don't see him as a bold experimenter in political science or social forms. He may change once he gets on a period of equality. I think, of course, he'll have his proportion of these people as he now has. There are Negroes who are nonconformists. There are Negroes who are atheists. There are Negroes who are even De Gaullists.
How much anti-Semitism do you think actually exists among Negroes?
That's a hard question.
I remember the Philadelphia episode,
yes,
and other episodes of the sort.
Well, I find that...
I've encountered it.
Yes, basically, the Negro is not anti-Semitic. And such anti-Semitism as he occasionally expresses stems from his own personal experience. It's like a white man who tells you that Negroes are no good. I knew one once and he did so-and-so to me, or he wouldn't do so-and-so. And Negroes who make anti-Semitic remarks are those who may have run into, say, a Jewish storekeeper, or a Jewish landlord, or a Jewish woman who is the boss of domestic servants. Now, these are the three areas in which they come in contact with Jewish families, with Jewish people generally. The landlord, the storekeeper, and the lady of the house where they work.
Yes.
And if they have an unfortunate experience with a Jewish housewife, let's say, they are likely, as most weak people are, to say, this Jewish lady did so-and-so. But if they work for an Irish woman or a German woman or a Swedish woman and she did precisely the same thing the Jewish woman did or had the same attitude, they would say, oh, that old white woman. You see?
Yes. Yeah. By other words, they have taken on some coloration of attitude from the floating Gentile white prejudices.
They have. They have also. But they have never forgotten, for example, I've traveled all over this country. I've met thousands upon thousands of Negroes. I've lived in their areas and I know them. They have never forgotten that wherever they have been, whatever kind of trouble they've been in, the Jews have helped them. Some Jews, either Jewish individuals or Jewish philanthropists or the Jewish rabbi. Invariably, when you go into a town and you ask the Negro community, who do you count among your friends in the white community? Among the first five people, always a Jewish rabbi. Always. He's a man who understands their problem, who sympathizes with them, who speaks to their meetings, who talks to them. So that anti-Semitism among them, I feel, is not virulent and not hateful. Although, like any kind of racial feeling, it is detestable. But it's not the kind of hate the Jew attitude that you find in some people.
You don't think it could be exploited by a black nationalist movement?
It has been.
Do you think it's a serious problem that way or not?
I don't think so. I think now the Muslims have attempted,
yes,
they've used anti-Semitism, but I don't believe they have gotten far. They've mouthed a few catchwords, and those catchwords have been taken up by their followers, but I don't believe that it has become part and parcel of the Negro community. In fact, I'm positive it has not. It just hasn't taken hold. Now, they're, even in the Deep South, they recognize that Jews have helped them. Jews have extended a hand. Jews have made loans to them. Jews have granted them credit. Jews have fought the battle against discrimination where they could. Remember, Jews have been vulnerable in the South, too. And they have not been able at all times to speak out. But in this present civil rights crisis that's developed since the Supreme Court decision in 1954, the Jewish community overwhelmingly has been on what we call our side. Now, there are Jews who are not on our side. There are Jews who are opposed to us and who have nothing to do with the civil rights movement.
As a Negro in New Orleans says, the country club Jews are against us.
Well,
it's hard to
classify them, but there are. Anytime you have 4 million people, you have all kinds of beliefs. And there are plenty of Jews that don't want to be bothered with the Negro problem, don't want to be identified with it. They don't want the Jews problem tied to the Negro problem.
That's a flight from Jewishness to a degree sometimes, isn't it?
Yes, but even the Jews, I go back to your question of some time ago about Negroes discovering themselves.
Yes.
I think the Jews have come to the place again. Again, where they, and they go periodically, they stray back and forth, but they have come in increasing numbers to Jewishness, to an appreciation of the Jewish worth, to pride in their own faith and religion, and into their own accomplishments. I mean, aside from the genuine pride they've always had. But I think the Jews have a feeling of their own that Jews amount to something, and Jews are important. And maybe some of them say, as one of them told me, a rabbi told me, my congregation told me they didn't want me to preach on the Negro question because they didn't want Jews identified with the Negro question. This was a very high-type Jewish congregation. Yet on the other hand, the rabbi of one of the most aristocratic and wealthiest Jewish congregations in the United States appeared on the same program with me, and not because I was there or anything about it, outlined a speech that could have been made by the finest liberal in the United States. So you can't classify him. You can't say the country club Jew or the wealthy Jew.
This is a quotation from...
Yes, I understand that. I understand that very well, yes.
You say liberal, and among the white friends of, you see, this raises a sort of question about the role of, say, white men in relation to the Negro movement or Negro revolution. On one hand, you will find such statements as one made by James Baldwin, the white liberalism affliction, and Isley's a fond farewell to the white liberal, or others, the white man stay off, or let's fire Jack Greenberg,
yeah.
all of these,
yeah.
Yankee go home.
Yes, yes, yes.
And on the other hand, you will find you saying, well, if you go away in time, leave us alone, we'll take charge, we're running the show.
Yeah.
The other hand, another attitude saying, if you come, you only make yourself contemptible, as it were. This is one form or another.
Yeah.
You are coming as a person who is, I'll put it best this way. In Mississippi, for instance, Robert Moses was taught the attitude of Negroes there toward white helpers from the outside want to over-identify.
Yeah.
It's contempt. The white man's naivete, his innocence, his desire to enter, to buddy up, to be one.
Yeah.
In other words, the white man can have, on these two poles, has no role. You see, if these, both these as the book commonly expressed, they why in one form or another they appear all over the place. They can be associated with the Negro movement in one way or another. That is, the white man can find no role acceptable, you see, to the Negro.
Yeah.
Insofar as you take these pronouncements and put them all together,
yes,
he has no place to come close, you see, to join, to affiliate, to help. He has no attitude that's acceptable he can even have in his heart. You see the problem?
Yes, I see the problem. I'm familiar with it. And I disagree very greatly with it.
With both of these attitudes?
Basically, yes. I disagree with it, although I understand why it exists in some cases. But I feel, first of all, that we ought to recognize that white people have been fighting for the liberty of the individual long before the Negro question of liberation ever came up.
This is a point of I think, of considerable importance, that the concept was fought for.
Yes.
And now it's a question of an application.
Exactly.
Particular application.
Well,
that's part of it.
Yes, that's right. That white people, beginning with long before the Magna Carta, were fighting against oppression and for the liberty of the individual. And they have fought, since we've had our country here, many battles not connected with race. They fought for freedom of the press and freedom of religion and all the sorts of things that they fought for. We ought to recognize that they have a heritage of protecting and enhancing the Constitution of the United States, irrespective of whether it applies to black people, white people, northerners or southerners. And that there can be sincere white people who believe in these principles and want to fight for them. And we ought not to shut them out of our movement because they don't fit into every niche and cranny of our thinking and our being. And they don't behave exactly as we feel they should behave as blood brothers. We're brothers, after all, in a cause, the cause of liberty.
As you are throwing the emphasis on the, if I understand you right, ultimately on the conceptual side of it.
That's part of it. And I would come, as soon as we finish here,
yes.
I would come to the other part.
Please do.
About his feeling of worming himself in and not being able to adjust. And let's come to that.
All right, fine. Now, this is the end of tape 2 of the conversation with Mr. Roy Wilkins. Proceed on tape 3.